persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. We're here this morning to take up oral argument in the case of United States versus Wade. Are both sides prepared to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
As is the appellant, Your Honor.
And it's my understanding, Mr. Cassera, you have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Very well. Please proceed.
Thank you, Judge. Morning, members of the court. Pleasure to see everybody this morning. Judge Markstein, I know I've argued before you before. I'm not sure if I've argued before the other two gentlemen, but it's a pleasure to be here. As you know, we are here to argue three assignments of error in the case of United States versus Wade. With the court's indulgence, unless the court has a preference otherwise, the appellant would prefer and request to start with assignment of error four. Judge Markstein, is that fine?
As you prefer.
Thank you, Judge. And judges, as it relates to assignment of error four, the appellant's general verdict must be set aside because the finding of guilty of larceny may well have rested on unlawful conduct, and that at least one of the theories of criminal liability advanced by the government was not prohibited by law. The standard of review for this assignment of error, Your Honors, is whether it is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and that is because while the sufficiency of a general verdict is reviewed de novo, the prejudice flowing from a constitutional error is reviewed under the Chapman type analysis of harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Your Honor, I think the court is well aware of the general rule as it relates to a general verdict, but under the Stromberg rule, as the court knows, a general verdict which potentially rests on lawful conduct is invalid. There have been several Supreme Court cases that have cited Stromberg over the years, and I'd like to go through those very briefly just to highlight them for the court. In Street v. New York, the court held that a single count indictment charging commission of a crime by constitutionally protected and unprotected activity cannot stand as the conviction may have rested on the constitutionally protected activity. In Batchelor v. Maryland, the court held that it is impossible to say from the evidence whether the convictions rested on a constitutionally protected allegation of fighting words or unprotected fighting words or constitutionally protected grounds of failure to obey a police order. In Griffin v. United States, the court said that where a provision of the Constitution forbids conviction on a particular ground, the constitutional guarantee is violated by a general verdict that may have rested on that ground. And finally, Your Honor, in Zant v. Stevens, the court held that if under the instructions to the jury, in our case the panel, one way of committing the offense charged is to perform an act protected by the Constitution, the rule of these cases requires that a general verdict of guilty must be set aside even if the defendant's unprotected conduct, considered separately, would support the verdict.
The cases you've discussed and the cases you cited in your brief generally stand for the proposition that if the defendant is possibly convicted of activity that involves constitutionally protected activity, then the general verdict cannot stand in that situation. Is there any constitutionally protected activity that the appellant was engaged in?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And that is, the Stromberg rule, actually, just where I was heading, is not limited to what we would traditionally call constitutionally protected activities, such as freedom of religion, freedom of expression, etc. Clearly, it would violate due process of the law to convict somebody of conduct that is not prohibited by
law. What is your primary authority for that proposition?
That's the Seventh Circuit Court case that we cited, Your Honor, Tenor v. Gilmore, which says that if a panel or a jury is told that the law forbids the doing of either A or B, and the verdict shows that the jury found the defendant did one of those things, but not which one, if one of the two is not a crime, a new trial must be ordered.
Tenor v. Gilmore had some very helpful and extended discussion drawing a distinction between the Yates scenario and the Griffin scenario. Which situation does this case more closely resemble and why?
Give me a second, Judge. And which two cases were you looking at, Judge? Just so I'm clear.
In Tenor v. Gilmore,
yes, sir.
The majority opinion there had some very helpful discussion drawing a distinction between the Yates scenario and the Griffin scenario. The Yates scenario being where there's a legal flaw
in the
way that the jury was instructed or in the law that was presented to the jury. The Griffin scenario being a flaw in the proof, a factual matter, Which situation does this scenario more closely resemble?
I would think this one falls more closely under either the Griffin or the Zent scenario in that one of the activities, and if you recall, Your Honor, during the government's closing argument, they made a point, and they stressed several times, that one of the ways that they could convict the appellant in this case was that the JFTR says that if you go TDY, you can't claim lodging expenses if you live with a family member or a relative. And the accused was not allowed to collect anything because he lived with his wife. That statement was correct in as far as it went, but it was incorrect in the sense that it was incomplete because it did not also include the follow-up language, which said that if he is living with a spouse and that spouse did not travel at government expense, then he is entitled to collect per diem or collect per diem at the single rate. So that portion of the appellant's conduct, which was the gravamen of what he did, was completely legal. But because the panel was, because the government advanced a theory, one of the theories of criminal liability that they advanced is completely constitutionally protected activity, and that it violates due process to convict somebody of something that is legal. And perhaps, you know, I've been trying to think of some analogies that I could give the court, and I've got one as it relates to later on, but I'm not sure what I really could hear. But the reality of it is that the government told the panel that they could convict the appellant of something that is completely legal.
And the reason it is completely legal, in your estimation, is because it is defined to be so by the language included in your brief taken from the JFT.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Correct.
Can you walk us through how does that provision apply in this case? I've read it. I'm not sure that I agree that it applies in this scenario. Under your interpretation of that provision, what was the appellant entitled to and why?
Your Honor, if I may pull up my brief where I actually quoted that, I believe it's on page 21 of my brief.
It is.
I'm looking at the government's brief. Excuse me, Your Honor. In the case at bar, Your Honor, the appellant traveled to and lived with his wife. His wife did not, there's no evidence in the record, I should say, that his wife traveled at government expense. As such, under the underlying provision on page 21, when a dependent is not traveling at government expense, the member is authorized the single room rate. That's what the JFTR says. The problem, of course, is that, one, the panel was not instructed properly, as we will talk about later, but two, in this case, that's exactly what happened. The government continually told the panel that they could convict the panel, that they could convict the appellant on these grounds, and it was simply incorrect.
Don't we have to read that provision in conjunction with the definition of permanent duty station? It's on, I think it's page 11 of your brief. The post of duty official station of a member, invitational traveler, including ship for purposes of travel and transportation. And then in other instances in your brief, both in cited excerpts from the JFTR, there's one on page 12 that again mentions travel and traveling and TDY. And again, in your argument on page 14, appellant applied for and received reimbursement for expenses related to travel. Under the JFTR, help me understand why this was travel and not permanent duty station.
Well, initially, Your Honor, I would say that I'm not sure, with all due respect to the court, that any of us fully understand the JFTR, but I'm going to do my best since it's my case. And that goes to the assignment of error that we're not arguing today, which is the mistake of fact defense. But if I understand the court's question correctly, Your Honor, roughly between travel and lodging?
Here's the crux of my question is, your argument turns on the notion that this was legal conduct as defined by the JFTR. If I read the provision on page 21 and the provision I just cited on page 11 in peri materia, you know, try and read them together in a way that doesn't, you know, set up an inherent conflict within the same body of law, I just come to the conclusion that nobody was traveling. Why is that not the case?
Because when he, and I think a lot of this has to do with, Your Honor, and I think this was fairly well developed in the record, but there's a significant difference between guardsmen who are called TDY and active duty or reserve personnel like yourselves or myself who are called TDY. As a National Guardsman, as the court knows, he is originally in a different status than when he is mobilized to active duty status. When he is mobilized to active duty status, he travels to that duty station. In fact, I think Colonel Robles The government's own witness, own expert said that this was travel in the sense that, and when he looked at that provision of the JFTR, said there's nothing in here that says that when he travels, on its face, that prohibits him from owning a home. So I think that the two provisions and the government's own expert show that this was travel, in which since he was traveling and his wife was not traveling at government expense, he was entitled to per diem at the single rate. The accused was allowed to claim mortgage interest because Section 4139 of the JFTR specifically provides for the cost of lodging with a dependent spouse so long as that spouse is not traveling at government expense.
In fact, the spouse was not traveling at all.
Not traveling at all. Which is not, you know, and John, as I know that we're stuck with, I mean, you know, it's not stuck with the record, but let me get to the record, but I think the court knows by its way of the world, you know, knowledge of the way the system works, that is not an uncommon scenario. And you're also dealing with states that are border states. It is certainly not uncommon that, you know, you saw in the record where his wife lived in Las Vegas. She was the vice president of a bank, and he was living with his parents and his in-laws in Utah. And so, you know, you've got this scenario that, frankly, is not that uncommon amongst military members, I would argue.
Does the JFTR even matter here? He was, the appellant claimed expenses that he never incurred. He claimed rental expenses at the second Las Vegas property. The record seems to very clearly indicate he never rented that house.
And he admitted
so
it.
Why do the provisions of the JFTR even matter?
Because the appellant was entitled to per diem. There's no question, Your Honors, and the appellant didn't deny this. He went about doing this completely the wrong way. I mean, there's no question about that. Although I think it's important for the court to recall that he was acquitted of the two specifications of making a false official statement. But under the JFTR, he's entitled to the per diem as a result of the fact that he is on orders, and if you recall, his order said full per diem authorized. There was nothing in the orders themselves or under the JFTR, under the provision that I just cited, which would say you have to pay the money. I mean, that's just simply absent from the facts of this case.
Is there a provision of the JFTR that says you're allowed to claim expenses you never incur?
Your Honor, I'm not prepared to answer that question. I don't know. Nor am I aware if there's a provision that says you can only be repaid expenses if you are actually incurring those expenses. I don't know that either one was ever developed in the record. Your Honor, finally, as it relates to this assignment of error, the standard is harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. Because it is possible that the members believe the appellant was guilty of larceny solely because he claimed reimbursement for expenses incurred while residing with his wife, as the government argued. It is also possible that the members may have completely accepted the appellant's position that he was confused about the manner in which he was supposed to submit his claim, but they convicted him anyway because they thought he wasn't entitled to reimbursement at all because he lived with his spouse. And this is the Holly case that we quoted, Your Honors, the Tenth Circuit case, which says that reliance on appeal on the valid ground without an actual panel or jury finding too closely resembles a presumption that the jury relied on that ground, undermining even the most narrow application of Stromberg. Therefore, under United States v. Stromberg and its progeny, the appellant's conviction of the sole remaining specification must be reversed. Moving to assignment of error 3, unless there are further questions on assignment of error 4. I know I'm doing this backwards, so it's hard for me to keep track of you. Please. The military judge erred in failing to instruct the members on the law regarding entitlements for the cost of lodging jointly occupied by a member and the defendant. And, Your Honor, we've touched on this, so I'll just touch on it very briefly. Once again, the standard of review as to whether members were properly instructed is reviewed de novo. This is a strange sort of hybrid area the appellant will concede as it relates to the proper standard of review, because you get into the difference between a mistaken instruction and an incomplete instruction. The appellant will argue that this case more closely follows United States versus Lewis, in which we are dealing with an incomplete instruction, in which the CAF said that the standard is harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. We all know the following. The military judge has a duty to properly instruct the members. The instruction should be tailored and fit the circumstances of the case. That's RCM 290 alpha. The military judge must provide such other explanations, descriptions, or directions as may be necessary and which are properly requested by a party or which the military judge determines sua sponte should be given. In the instant case, the members were instructed on the regulation stated that they're not entitled to reimbursement, that the appellant was not entitled to reimbursement for staying with a friend or relative. They were not instructed on the very next provision of the law, which says when a dependent is not traveling at government expense, the member is entitled to the single room rate.
Counsel, do you see a difference between staying with a friend or relative and a friend or relative staying with you? In terms of the situation that you have here with your client, that he was apparently, from the record, staying with his wife in the house that she owned, that they owned,
that they owned
at Cactus Desert Court.
Yes, sir.
As opposed to had neither one of them lived in that area, he traveled down there and was staying at the single officer's quarters. She chose to come down and visit him, and they chose to incur additional expenses and stay in the TLF. And he would be reimbursed only at the single officer quarter rate. Do you see a difference between those two scenarios?
I see a difference between those two, Your Honor, because in one of them, in the second of your scenarios, he's moving into the BOQ as opposed to a home that he already owned. I don't think it makes a difference. For example, if, I think under the JFTR, actually, it does make a difference if they were both living in the home. But in the, I think the important thing to remember about the case, in fact, is that nothing prohibited him, according to the government's witness, from purchasing the home prior to going TDY. So whether or not his wife was living in the home prior to him getting there, according to the government's own expert, was irrelevant. But under the JFTR, or at least as one would read the JFTR, according to the plain language of the JFTR, there's nothing in there that says you must purchase the home upon arrival at your duty station. The government argued to the members that they could convict on the theory that the JFTR says if you go TDY, you can't claim lodging expenses, and if you live with a family member or a relative. And the appellant was therefore not allowed to collect anything because he lived with his wife, a family member. Again, Your Honors, that argument was only true for as far as it went. It did not include the next portion of the JFTR, which is what we're going to talk about in Assignment of Error 2, as it relates to the incomplete instruction given by the military judge.
Was there anything incorrect in the instruction given by the military judge?
It is incomplete. I think inherently if something is incomplete, it is incorrect. It's only half the story.
Were the provisions that were cited correctly cited?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And
the military.
It's only when the trial counsel's argument came up, is that the point where the military judge should sua sponte issued an instruction on the provision that you cite?
Absolutely. When he should have done it, Judge, during instructions or when he gave the other instruction on judicial notice, when he judicially noted the other circle thing, I don't think when he does it is the issue.
Well, that's a critical question, right? I mean, did the incompleteness, the confusion, if you will, that you allege occurred here, did that arise at the time of the instructions or did that arise at the time of trial counsel's argument? Were the instructions that were given unclear, or was it trial counsel's interpretation of the instructions that raised the ambiguity?
I think both, Judge. I mean, I think that the trial counsel, by arguing something that is only half the law, and the military judge, by not instructing them entirely on the law, are both erroneous. And, Judge, I think the best, and here I knew I had an analogy for you, they don't usually work, but I'll try. If a military judge were to instruct a panel and say, on an Article 120 case, and leave out substantial incapacitation, and it's a substantial incapacitation case. If the government is arguing that the alleged victim was substantially incapacitated, and the military judge doesn't do anything to dissuade the panel of the notion that that's one of the elements, we have an incomplete instruction. And it also ties directly into the final assignment of error, which is that the military judge erred in instructing the members that they could disregard the regulation that he had taken judicial notice of. So what you have is a compound problem in this case. One is the military judge clearly, I don't know if there's any really room for disagreement to the fact that the appellate, and I rarely say that to an appellate court because you may disagree, but I think the military judge clearly failed to give the proper instruction as to what the panel could do with judicial notice of law. The combination of the fact that he failed to give the proper instruction as it relates to judicial notice of law and the failure to properly instruct the panel on the complete elements of the JFTR lead to reversible error. Once again, whether a panel was properly instructed is reviewed de novo. Once again, the manual is somewhat unclear as to what the standard of review, and candidly, Your Honors, I've only found one case addressing Military Rule of Evidence 201 Alpha, and that did not state what the proper standard of review for an appellate court was. Therefore, I would argue that we should default to Article 59A of the manual and say that, you know, we look at it for harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt and whether it deprived the appellant of a fair trial. Your Honor, I think it's important to remember that we are dealing with, as you know, Military Rules of Evidence 201 and 201 Alpha. Judicial notice of facts versus judicial notice of law. Under Military Rule of Evidence 201, judicial notice of adjudicated facts, there clearly is a provision under Military Rule of Evidence 201G that says the military judge shall instruct the members that they may but are not required to accept as conclusive any matter judicially noticed. Military Rule of Evidence 201 Alpha states that the military judge may take judicial notice of domestic law, and when he or she does, the procedures of MRE 201 apply except for 201G, meaning that the military judge cannot instruct the members that they may disregard judicially noticed matters under MRE 201 Alpha.
Skipping ahead to prejudice, where's the prejudice? In this fact scenario, is there any likelihood at all that the members would be tempted to flat out disregard the provisions of the JFTRs instructed by the military judge?
Well, I think there's a very clear danger of that, Your Honor, because if you recall, this is what we've been talking about all along, the government's main theme, I mean, the appellant's main theme was he just simply misunderstood and simply did all of this wrong. The government argued, or the panel rather, may very well have concluded, well, it doesn't matter because he violated the JFTR. And therefore, whether or not he had an honest and reasonable mistake of fact was irrelevant because he violated the black letter of the Military Rule of Evidence, and or rather of the JFTR, and we've been told we can disregard all of that.
What possible reason would the members have for disregarding what the JFTR says?
Because the military judge told them that they could. I mean, they may have just found that because he did this improperly, that he's guilty, almost in a strict liability type of argument. Because he didn't fill out the paperwork correctly, that doesn't matter. And Your Honor, respectfully, you asked me, does the JFTR even apply? I mean, it's entirely possible that the panel said, well, the JFTR may not apply because the military judge told us we don't have to pay attention to it. And we presume panel members follow our instructions.
Or the JFTR may not apply because he claimed for expenses he never incurred, which is a totally legitimate reason why the members may not find that the JFTR matters in this scenario.
But the problem, Your Honors, is that we don't know. And when you combine that with the Stromberg issue, we are left with the very real possibility that the panel rests their verdict on constitutionally protected grounds because they were told that the JFTR may not apply.
Child Defense Counsel did not object to the military judge's language in the instruction, did not request that the military judge issue additional instructions, including paragraph U4139. Isn't this normally some indication of lack of prejudice?
Your Honor, respectfully, I think that in the throes of a hotly contested court-martial, it may have just been a mistake. I don't know. I would almost find it hard to believe that any counsel would knowingly and intentionally waive an instruction in which, and going back to my analogy of the substantial incapacitation, if the military judge reads the elements of substantial incapacitation, but then says, you can ignore my instructions, and maybe the panel thinks, well, she was moderately intoxicated, not substantially intoxicated, and the judge has said that we can ignore whether she was substantially intoxicated. You're dealing with the exact same issue in this case, in which the military judge instructs the panel, fails to completely instruct them, and then tells the panel, you can disregard one of the parts that I have instructed you on. And, Your Honor, I will say that in almost 25 years of doing this, I think I'm ahead of time. So subject to any further questions from the members of the court, that will conclude my presentation.
Just a couple of wrap-ups.
Yes, Your Honor.
Again, bringing it back, the crux of your argument that he was engaged in lawful activity turns on the interpretation of what you described as the almost incomprehensible JFTR, correct?
Having read the JFTR, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And our standard of review for a military judge's instructions to members is de novo, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
If the JFTR is impenetrably complicated and some of the provisions appear contradictory one way or the other, by what standard are we to evaluate a judge's decision not to include some of this stuff because the judge simply concluded, hey, there's no travel implicated here, it's not a traveler?
Well, we don't have anything on the record that would tell us that, Judge.
I agree. I realize I'm asking kind of a hypothetical. I'm just curious what your thoughts on it, because it will help me place your argument in context.
Sure. Well, Your Honor, there is no way that you can convict the appellant of larceny without referencing the JFTR. I mean, there are two parts to the larceny argument on the government side. One is that he got money that he wasn't entitled to, and two is that he did so with the intent to steal. I mean, that's fairly simple. 50% of that requires that he receive money that he was not entitled to. The only way to determine whether he was or was not entitled to the money is through the JFTR. And respectfully, as complicated as the JFTR may be, and obviously that relates to our mistake of fact issue in Assignment of Error 6, as complicated as the JFTR may be, it was the standard by which the panel was instructed. And then we're told that you may disregard it. And again, respectfully, I think it's fairly clear that that portion of the instruction was completely improper. Anything further from members of the court? Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. I'm Captain Thomas Alford, along with Colonel Don Christensen. We represent the government in this case. Today, on appeal, for the first time, appellant argues three instructional errors. I say for the first time because at trial, appellant did not bring any of these objections up. Now, viewing each of these alleged instructional errors under the appropriate plain error standard, it should be abundantly clear to this court that the military judge below did not plainly err in a way that substantially affected or materially affected appellant's substantial rights when he instructed the members concerning his larceny of military property. Now I'm going to take each assignment of error in order, and starting with assignment of error number 2 with regard to the military rule of evidence 201. The judge instructed the members that they may but are not required to accept as conclusive portions of the JFTR, specifically paragraph 4137, which appellant highlights, and that has to deal with, in particular, mortgage interest. Now, while the military judge did err when he recited verbatim the military bench book instruction regarding judicial notice, this mistake applied to all portions judicially noticed.
So the government does concede error on the military judge's instruction?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So that's changed from the government's brief submitted in this case?
It is, Your Honor, yes. Now, but this error applied equally to the government and to appellant, because if you look at this, the portions that were judicially noticed, including the portion that appellant today complains of, was a provision that the government had asked for judicial notice of. So when you're conducting a prejudice analysis here, and by the way, this is a plain error standard under RCM 920F.
Why is it not de novo, right? Military judges instruct the correctness of military judges' instructions normally reviewed under a de novo standard, regardless of whether the parties object.
Well, I think on the front end, Your Honor, whether there was error to begin with is a de novo review, but whether in analyzing the entire issue, it's a plain error issue because the counsel did not object to that particular issue. But in assessing whether, even under a plain error context, whether there was error to begin with, whether that was plain, that's a de novo review. But then looking at whether appellant's rights were actually prejudiced under that plain error standard, the burden then falls on appellant to show the prejudice in this particular case, and he can't show it. Under U.S. v. Cooper, unobjected to instructional errors are tested for a plain error analysis. That's 65 MJ 49. That's a CAF case from 2007. That's cited in our brief. United States v. Payne was a case that CAF recently decided that is not cited in our brief, and I will provide a supplemental citation. But U.S. v. Payne was actually, there was a missing element altogether. And the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces reviewed the front end, the error de novo, and viewed the entire issue under a plain error context. But to make things a little bit more confusing, they concluded that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And that the United States v. Payne was a 2014 CAP case, 73 MJ 19. Now, With regard to the prejudice prong under military rule of evidence, the 201 issue, as I mentioned, under U.S. v. Maynard, 66 MJ 242, he bears the burden to show that there was actually prejudice here. And there was no unfair prejudicial impact on the jury's deliberations by telling the members that they were not required to conclusively accept the JFTR. And that's simply because if the members disregarded paragraph U4137 dealing with mortgage interest, that's the one that appellant highlights, in assessing whether that was prejudicial, that provision only applies, number one, if appellant was actually TDY, which was the entire issue of the case. That was one of the theories the government floated, was that he wasn't even TDY to begin with. And number two, even if this section did apply, appellant submitted reimbursement not for lodging, not for mortgage interest, but for lodging. He was filing false documents to get lodging back. He was basically renting from himself, even though he admitted that he never actually paid himself. So this particular provision regarding mortgage interest and et cetera, utilities, that had nothing to do with the actual case. It was, number one, whether he was TDY, and even if he was TDY, he was submitting documents that weren't for mortgage interest. Further, in assessing your plain error analysis, you look to the strength of the government's case, and if the court would entertain me going through a few facts here. Appellant changed his address 6 times coinciding with TDY's. That's a record at page 246. So when he would go TDY to Utah, he would switch his residence to Las Vegas, and then vice versa. When he would go TDY from Las Vegas, he would say that he was when you go to Utah TDY, he would say that his residence was in Las Vegas. He even admitted on cross-examination that he lived in Las Vegas, not Utah, since 2006, and he had purchased that Cactus Court address there with his wife in 2006. That's the record at 438. His tax forms, his 1040s from 2009 and 2010, showed his residence was listed as the Cactus Court address in Las Vegas. That's Prosecution Exhibit 11 and 12, and at the record at 399. So when he started working at Nellis in 2009, he was not TDY. And so this provision that appellant now complains of wasn't relevant to this particular case, so he couldn't be prejudiced by it. He also acknowledged reluctantly on cross-examination that his residence was in Las Vegas from 2006 to 2008, as well as, I believe it was, late 2008 and early 2009, and that's at 446 and 447. He bought his second property in Las Vegas. That's the Bar Hill Avenue address, which he was charging himself rent for, allegedly, prior to the start of his TDY, and that's in contravention of paragraph 4137, as well as the comptroller's testimony that basically, if you want to start charging the government mortgage interest, you would have had to purchase a primary residence while you were TDY, not prior to it. And this is a secondary residence purchased prior to his TDY. And he also only started requesting lodging after the purchase of
the... When did his TDY start? You said that he bought the Barville Avenue residence prior to his TDY. What TDY and when did that start?
His TDY, I believe, started in November of 2008.
And when did he buy the Barville Avenue property?
That was... I think that was in July of 2009, so I may have crossed the dates there, Your Honor. But so November 2008, he did go on active duty to Nellis. But during that time, in the initial portion, he wasn't charging the government any lodging. So in July of 2009, when he purchased that property, then at that point, that's when he started charging the government lodging, contemporaneous with when he started the limited liability corporation that had no identifying characteristics that identified him as the owner so he could bill the government.
I understood that there are other facts that might support the government's case here, but we need to make sure we have the record clear here.
Yes, sir. And I think what I crossed here was that the Cactus Court address was purchased prior to his TDY. So even that address, if he was saying that he was charging mortgage interest on that address, because that was purchased in 2006, he couldn't do under the JFTR. So that's, I believe, my point there.
Let me ask you this. Some of the facts that you're running back through, and I
appreciate that. I mean, it sounds like you're talking about a factual sufficiency argument with regard to the intent element, right? Is that what?
Well, I think no matter what.
Let me put that question in a larger context. If we're talking about a guy who thinks he found a loophole, and it's a loophole based on a pretty thick tome worth of sometimes what appears to be inherently contradictory provisions, but if he thought he found a lawful loophole and executed it monumentally clumsily, he's still not guilty of larceny, right?
Well, I think there's a couple of big ifs there, Your Honor.
Right. Agreed, 100%. With that basic proposition, though, do you agree?
Your Honor, the mistake of fact as to larceny is that he had to have an honest belief. So to answer your question, yes, if he had an honest belief that he was entitled to this and he was doing it in that manner, then yes, I agree with you. And the reason I'm highlighting these factual issues is because under a plain error prejudice standard, you do have to look at the strength of the government's case, and this applies to all three assignments of error. But if you look at his cross-examination, I think the members could easily dispose of this. The record at 406, he characterizes him submitting documents with a limited liability corporation set up days before he starts asking for lodging reimbursement from the government. He calls it a paperwork error. And if there's any doubt of prejudice under this assignment of error, I would just ask this court to reread the appellant's self-serving and his basically convoluted testimony, and that starts at 387 and ends at 475, where he talks about, he has this long convoluted story about why he changed his residence several different times, and he also calls this blatant attempt to fraud the government as a paperwork error, and the members could easily judge his credibility, and you do have to take that into account when you're doing that factual and legal sufficiency review.
This question will bleed over somewhat to all three issues we're discussing today, but you've recited several facts or several more in the briefing and the record as to how the larceny was committed. Obviously, this was a general verdict under a very broadly worded charge and specification. When we're conducting either a factual sufficiency review or analyzing this issue for prejudice, any of these issues for prejudice, what is the government's theory as to how exactly the larceny was committed here? Was it the fact that he was submitting travel vouchers at all during this time period? In other words, is the government's theory simply that he was really living in Las Vegas and wasn't traveling at all? Or is the government's theory as to why he was convicted simply that he submitted the receipts for the Barmer Avenue property?
Your Honor, I think that there's two main theories, and then there's a third theory that the government maintained at trial. But the two theories here that the government would still stand by are, number one, that he wasn't TDY to begin with. That his home, that his residence was in Las Vegas, that's indicative by the fact that he had lived there since 2006. It was on his tax forms. He worked there, et cetera, et cetera. His wife lived there. Then there's the big, even if that's the case, he was submitting paperwork to request reimbursement for lodging expenses when he wasn't renting, or he wasn't staying at a hotel. He wasn't renting from a third party. He was renting from himself, which the JFTR specifically precludes. The third theory the government floated in passing, and I'll get to this in the last assignment of error, the third theory basically is that that even if he was entitled to this stuff, even if he was TDY, even if he was entitled to it, he still couldn't have done it because his wife lived there. So this was the third theory that the government, and it was only a theory in passing. So focusing on that third assignment of error, whether an affirmative defense was then raised that the military judge should have sua sponte then instructed on this other paragraph to rebut that particular JFTR section, the threshold question is, number one, is that even an affirmative defense for larceny? The government maintains it is not. And number two, was an instruction discussing JFTR paragraph U4139 even raised by the evidence? And the answer is no. Trial defense counsel never once argued or alleged that appellant was renting or staying at a lodging facility with his wife. The main issue at trial was whether appellant had made a paperwork error concerning mortgage interest, not lodging. So the military judge, without any, again, this is a plain error analysis under 920F, military judge, sua sponte, how was he to know that the defense then, later on appeal, was going to come up with this particular supposed affirmative defense? The onus was on the defense counsel at trial to bring this up, and there was zero evidence for the military judge to even bring this up. I mean, Your Honors know that the JFTR is a voluminous regulation, and to impose on the military judge under a plain error scenario that it would be plain error for him not to bring this up is absurd when there is zero evidence on the record that that's the way that the defense counsel was going.
What's the government's interpretation of paragraph U4139 that the appellant cites here? Does that apply in this situation?
Your Honor, I'm going to have to say that I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think so, because especially given the facts of this particular case, it's a relevant period because he was never charging the government for lodging. So this was just not something that we even have to concern ourselves with. If he was staying at the Nellis Desert Inn and, you know, there was some kind of paperwork error, then maybe the appellant would have an argument that that should have been brought up. But still, the defense counsel should have brought this up if he truly believed that this was a defense. Now, going to the prejudice on this particular prong, too, you do have to look at whether or not this would have any effect on the findings. Appellant was not, as I've mentioned several times, he wasn't TUI'd in Dallas. His residence since 2006 was Las Vegas, not Utah. And although he may have been a Utah resident for CICRA purposes, his home of record, his residence, was in Las Vegas. So this error could not have had, if there was an error, this could not have had any effect on the findings whatsoever. And assuming for the sake of argument that appellant indeed was TUI, the lack of this particular instruction could not have impacted the findings because, as I mentioned before, appellant never rented a hotel, he never rented an apartment. In fact, he said on his cross-examination that he never even lived at the property that he was billing the government for, the second property. And in 2010, there was a resident who moved into that property and was renting from him, and he claimed a loss on his taxes. So this idea that he somehow was entitled to the single room rate or some kind of rental reimbursement is absurd. Now, last, with regard to the assignment of error 4, and that's the general verdict issue, whether the guilty finding of diverse larceny was based on lawful conduct. Now, even if for the sake of argument the government argued a factually insufficient theory of guilt, the normal general verdict rule from Rodriguez should apply, since no instructed theory was a legally insufficient theory or one that invoked some kind of constitutionally protected conduct under Stromberg and the legally sufficient under Yates. So appellant is basically mixing apples and bowling balls here. He's arguing that there is a Barbary-Stromberg issue when all this could be potentially, and the government doesn't concede this, is an improper argument by trial counsel. The trial counsel was basically putting forth a factually insufficient theory, and kind of going back to your question, Judge Weber, we don't necessarily think that was even a factually insufficient theory based on the ambiguous nature of 4139 that appellant asked that this court basically take judicial notice of. Now, appellant argues without citation or a scintilla of legal authority on page 19 of his brief that, quote, all lawful conduct is constitutionally protected. Now, this type of general due process attack was squarely rejected by the Supreme Court in Griffin versus United States. That's 503 U.S. 46. And appellant further argues that Barbary demands that the general verdict be set aside since the government briefly argued that appellant was not entitled to lodging if he stayed with his wife. But the facts here, unlike Barbary or any other general verdict case really since Yates, is that the military judge never instructed the members on a constitutionally protected theory of guilt. In fact, he never instructed the members on a legally insufficient theory of guilt like as in Yates and then in the Seventh Circuit case that appellant has maintained. He took judicial notice of certain portions of the JFTR. Appellant can't say that any of these portions were incorrect, that the military judge said something was illegal that wasn't illegal. He just put these portions of the JFTR out there. And then it was on the members to make that factual determination. So there is no legal issue, and there's nothing constitutionally protected about staying at one's wife and lodging. So the general verdict rule of Rodriguez, which is 66 MJ 201, that should be applied. And the trial counsel's argument, the only argument floated by the government in this massive record of trial, and I'll quote it, in closing argument, and this is at 537, the trial counsel said, not only was he not allowed to collect anything because he lived with his wife, a family member, he wasn't submitting receipts for mortgage interest, it was rental income on a second property. So even in this kind of sub-theory, the trial counsel was arguing the main theory that even that it was irrelevant whether lodging was an issue because he wasn't renting any property, he wasn't staying in a hotel. Now in Rodriguez, CAF held that when members find an accused guilty on a diverse occasion specification, they need only determine that the accused committed two acts that satisfied the elements of the crime as charged. And the long-standing common law rules that when a fact finder returns a guilty verdict on an indictment charging several acts, the verdict stands on review even if the evidence is sufficient with respect to any one of the acts charged. Now, Barberi did have an exemption or an exception to that general verdict rule when the conduct is constitutionally protected, like an image of, like in the area of free speech, like in Barberi. But appellant can't point to a constitutionally protected right here that was floated by the government. And as I mentioned before, they can't even mention, as in Judge Stuckey's concurrence in Barberi, a legally insufficient theory that the military judge instructed on. And that's really what Barberi gets after, too, is it's the instructions. It's not the theory floated by the government. It's whether they were instructed on a constitutionally protected or a legally insufficient theory.
So if a military judge instructs a jury, a person who engages in this conduct is guilty of a crime, and there's another provision of law that says, unless he was doing X, Y, or Z, and the judge doesn't instruct on that, that comports with the constitutional requirement for due process. Is that what I'm understanding you to say?
No, Your Honor. I think if the military judge instructed on two separate theories of guilt, and one of those theories of guilt was later found to be legally insufficient, then you might have a colorable argument that there is some kind of violation here of the general verdict rule based on Yates. But even the Supreme Court said that Yates is on shaky ground in Griffith. But if it's some kind of affirmative defense issue, that's an instructional error issue. And as I mentioned, in Payne, even a missing element, if the military judge fails to instruct on an element, that is under a plain error analysis if the defense counsel doesn't object. So even in that scenario, it's not something that can't be overcome in a prejudice prong, but that's not what we have here. Article 121, there is no affirmative defense that the military judge missed. Appellant is just merely creating what he thinks is an affirmative defense and saying, oh, I found this other portion of the JFTR that might have applied. So it was not a required instruction that required a sua sponte instruction, if that answers your question, Your Honor.
Keep going. I'll figure out for myself in a moment whether or not it did.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'd also quote United States v. Vidal, that's 23 MJ 319, and this is cited in Rodriguez. It makes no difference how many members chose one act or the other, one theory of liability or the other. The only condition is that there be evidence sufficient to justify a finding of guilty on any theory of liability submitted to the members. And that's also in U.S. v. Brown, 65 MJ 356. And if there aren't any other questions, Your Honor, I'd like to briefly conclude.
Please.
As trial counsel rightly argued at trial, appellant manipulated the government travel system for his own financial gain. He represented that he resided in Utah when, since 2006, he had lived with his wife in Las Vegas. As a result, he stole over $50,000 of military property. At trial, appellant never objected to the three issues before you today. Now he manufactures these issues in the vain hope that he will be entitled to relief, despite the fact that he cannot point to any prejudice, even if the military judge erred, plainly erred. Again, viewing each of these alleged instructional errors under the appropriate plain error standard, this court should find that the military judge below did not plainly err when he instructed the members properly concerning his larceny of thousands of dollars of military property. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, members of the court. The government states that the appellant cannot point to a constitutional provision that was violated in this case. I will try and make it simple. If you are convicted of something that is not a crime, that violates the Constitution. It is a violation of due process for one to be convicted of something that is not a crime. All of the cases that the government counsel cites to deal with a scenario in which all of the alleged misconduct was illegal and a general verdict was handed in and which would allow for a conviction of any one of a series of illegal activities. In the instant case, one of the theories that the government argued, as the government counsel just stated, I believe it was Judge Marksteiner said, what are the three, why is this illegal? Tell us why this violated, why this is a larceny. And one of the three scenarios that the government counsel stated was that even if he was entitled to the money, he could not collect it if his wife was living there. That is an incorrect statement of the JFTR. That is the same mistake that the trial counsel made at trial. So therefore, the government is now asking this court to affirm on constitutionally protected conduct. And the constitutional protection, again, being that one cannot be convicted of something that is not a crime.
Counsel, if you could clarify for me again, how do you reconcile 4129, the instruction that was read to the members, that lodging cost reimbursement is not authorized for a member who stays with a friend or relative, and the provision that you contest should have been read, 4139, that when the dependent is not traveling at government expense, the member is authorized the single room rate?
I think 4139 is an exception to 4137. 4137 being the general rule that you cannot do this except for in the scenario enunciated in 4139. That's how I read it, Your Honor. How a panel would have read it, had it been instructed on it, I obviously can't say. But that is the way that the appellant, that I read it.
Even under your interpretation, he's only entitled to reimbursement at the single rate.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that what he was reimbursed for?
No, but I do recall, Your Honor, and I could supplementally check, I recall that there was testimony that the amount that he received was no greater than what he would have received had he received it at the single rate. But I'm saying that off the top of my brain on a 500-some-odd page record, Your Honor. And the government counsel has stated several times that there was not a requirement to read something because the appellant did not raise this as an affirmative defense. So again, I'm trying to make the appellant's position clear. This is not an affirmative defense. It is an absolute defense. If one was doing something that was perfectly legal, and Judge Weichsteiner, you called it a possible loophole under the regulation. Maybe it is. But if what the appellant was doing was completely legal, that is a defense. It is not an affirmative defense, as we know that term under the law. And the government has, again, made the same mistake that they made in their brief, which is analyzing these three assignments of error under a plain error standard. They are not. We would encourage the court to look at the cases cited by the appellant and supplementally cited just in my brief where I gave you a couple of new cases, that you will conclude that this is a standard of harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. The government counsel cited Payne. I would encourage the court to read it. Respectfully, I disagree with the government's reading of Payne. I do not believe that is what U.S. v. Payne stands for. And then finally, Your Honors, I would like to address the issue that's sort of been bantered about a little bit, which is whether or not the appellant was on TDY status during this time that he was in Las Vegas. The government at trial requested that the provision of the JFTR on TDY travel be read to the panel members. Obviously, there was at least a theory out there, one of the many government theories, that he was on TDY. And in fact, if you look again at Colonel Robles' testimony on page 39 of, which we highlight on page 39 of our brief, in which he says that when a member is on a TDY status, there's nothing, the JFTR does not say that they cannot purchase a home prior to going on that status. So again, respectfully to the government counsel, the playing field seems to be shifting a little bit. It is clear that the appellant was on, that one of the government's theory was that the appellant was on a TDY status. Your Honors, I see that my time is up. Subject to any further questions from the members of the court? That concludes my presentation.
Well, so again, I want to go back to 4129, and I'm going to look at example one, which was not read to the members. I believe it was not read to the members, but it says, a member, outpatient, and a DOD civilian employee, each traveling under an official TUI travel authorization to location A, reside together with family members who live at or near location A during the TDY. They commute daily to the TDY location. The member is not authorized lodging reimbursement. Isn't that exactly the situation we have here, that the member is not authorized lodging reimbursement because they're staying with a family member?
Your Honor, I think that in the provision that you read said that he was commuting back and forth on a daily basis
to the TDY location from where he was staying. Isn't that what your client was doing? He was commuting back and forth from Cactus Desert Court to his TDY location, which was Nellis?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think that that envisions a scenario in which the appellant lives, you know, I mean, the appellant lives with his wife all the time, or with his family member all the time at the time of the TDY. If you'll recall, in this case, the appellant was living in Nevada, had a Nevada driver's license, was paying Nevada taxes when the TDY came up, which is why I think that the provision of 4139 that we cited in our brief is the appropriate applicable provision. But again, Your Honor, I think it points out the underlying issue in this entire case is that the panel was not given the opportunity to make that decision based on evidence that was lawfully before them. Thank you, members of the court.
Okay. We thank both sides for your obviously well-thought-out and well-prepared arguments. There being no other matters to take up before the court at this time, we're adjourned. We'll render a decision in due course.
Thank you, Judge.